want to say thank you to Hallie for stepping in kind of at the last minute. Cheryl was unable to play with us this morning. I think she headed off to see some grandkids. Shame on her, you know. So that's what happens. You get these educators, they have President's Day off. They just disappear for the weekend. But Hallie pitched in, and thank you so much, Hallie, for your contributions this morning. If you have your Bibles, let's turn back to Ecclesiastes, and Ecclesiastes 7. We've been in this book of Ecclesiastes, kind of making our way through over the past number of months. And so we're at Ecclesiastes 7, and we're going to start at verse 15 this morning and read to the end of the chapter. And trust me, you as you listen, you will go, "What in the world are we going through here?" Because it's an interesting passage. So, Ecclesiastes chapter 7, starting at verse 15. "In my vain life I have seen everything. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing. Be not overly righteous, and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. Wisdom gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed others. All this I have tested by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been far off and very, very deep, who can find it out? I turned my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom and the scheme of things and to know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. And I find something more bitter than death. The woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken by her. Behold, this is what I found, says the preacher, while adding one thing to another to find the scheme of things, which my soul has sought repeatedly, but I have not found. One man among 1,000 I found, but a woman among these, all these I have not found. See, this alone I found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes." Like I said, interesting passage, right? Author Mark Twain, many years ago, wrote a short story entitled "The Story of the Little Bad Boy Who Didn't Come to Grief." It was a story of a boy named Jim. Unlike what happens, what the Sunday school books say happens to such boys who are mischievous, nothing bad happens to Jim in Mark Twain's short story. For example, and I quote, he climbed up Farmer Acorn's apple tree to steal apples, and the limb didn't break, and he didn't fall and break his arm, and he didn't get torn up by the farmer's great dog, and then languish on a sick bed for weeks and repent and become good. That did not happen. Then there was the time he went boating on Sunday, and he didn't get drowned. And that time he got caught out in a storm when he was fishing on Sunday, and he didn't get struck by lightning. And after recalling one episode after another, the story concludes with Jim all grown up. And Twain relays how Jim got wealthy by all manner of cheating and rascality, and now he is the infernalist, wickedest scoundrel in his native village, and is universally respected and belongs to the legislature. There you go. Just like today, right? Moving on. But Twain's story makes us laugh about the inequities of life, doesn't it? Such as an exceedingly bad boy being rewarded with good things, or at least escaping punishments for his bad deeds. But in all seriousness, no, we know that injustice, as we see it in earth, is not a laughing matter. You know, we struggle with that lazy neighbor who makes more money than we do. Right? We struggle with that star athlete who kills his wife and gets away with it because he's a celeb. Or that Middle Eastern tyrant whose power grows unchecked daily. Even more, we struggle with the opposite. There is certainly nothing funny about bad things happening to good people. What do we do, for example, with the story of the young couple who celebrated their first pregnancy only to discover their daughter had trisomy 18, a deadly genetic disorder? Little Elizabeth only lived 5 days. A year later, a son was born to them. They named him Joseph because Joseph means the Lord adds. Yet shortly after the boy turned one, Joseph died in his sleep. How do we process something like that? And what do we do with our own sad stories? Because you have them, I have them. How do we handle living in a world that is so very crooked, so very warped, a world where life does not turn out the way we expected it would? We're in the midst of a study on the book of Ecclesiastes entitled Finding Meaning in Futility. And in this book, the author, the preacher of Jerusalem, I think most likely King Solomon in his later years, struggles to make sense of the meaningless, the elusiveness, the futility of life in this world. And as we've seen over the past few weeks, he continues to observe difficult things. But one of the things he has turned to over and over for at least answers or a way out of some of this futility is wisdom. We saw that last week. You know, he talked about how we should consider the path of wisdom. That's one of those hard choices we ought to make. We've seen more than once that wisdom is a good option. Much better than its opposite, at least, which is folly. The wise path seems to be the best path for us to navigate life in our crooked world. With that in mind, we come to our passage this morning. And in Ecclesiastes 7, the preacher, at 15 to 29, the preacher again speaks about wisdom. But here it looks a little different. Instead of portraying wisdom in positive terms, his picture of wisdom is primarily negative here. He clearly articulates for us that wisdom has its limits. There are things wisdom cannot do. There are reasons the life path of wisdom is lacking in some areas. And since he is primarily talking about, remember, he's talking about life under the sun, right? He's talking about life from an earthly perspective. We have to note that when he talks about wisdom, he's talking about human wisdom here. He's talking about our wisdom, maybe the wisdom sometimes that we're very proud of. That's what he's talking about. And while he is quick to admit in this book that wisdom is much better, wisdom is good, much as wisdom is much better than folly, we don't want to set up wisdom as the ultimate answer. Because human wisdom does not provide all the solutions. And so the limits of wisdom remind us to look for true wisdom elsewhere. The limits of our human wisdom and we're going to see some of those limits as we unpack this passage. The limits of our human wisdom remind us to look for true wisdom, the wisdom that truly gives us hope, truly answers the questions of life. We need to look for that elsewhere because we're not going to find it in ourselves. In order to set the stage for this passage, we have to glance quickly back to last week's passage. If you remember, those of you that were here last week, you know, in the middle of the snowstorm or whatever, those brave few souls of you, the first half of chapter 7 is the portrait of a better life, right? You know, he's talking about the better life includes, as we saw, wisdom. It includes choosing the path of wisdom. It includes recognition of God's sovereignty. And as Solomon makes clear in verses 13 through 14, you know, the verses right before our passage, this world is crooked. What does he say? Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? This world is crooked. It's bent. It's twisted. It's perverted. God has made it that way, he says. And so as human beings, our best option in verse 14 is to look faithfully to God in every day, days of plenty, days of adversity, knowing that God is sovereign. God has made both of those kind of days. Now in the verses following our passage this morning, the preacher picks up on this idea of crookedness. Now I get you, the word crooked is not in our passage. It's not going to be there. But the assumption of crookedness is everywhere. And specifically, the preacher wants us to focus on how the crookedness of this world has tainted even that path of wisdom, that good path he has encouraged us to pursue, so that even the so-called wise choices we desire to make, they're not ultimate choices, because our human wisdom has limits. And so as we begin to unpack the limits of wisdom, the first thing we see here is wisdom's danger. In verses 15 to 18, we discover that wisdom misapplied can be dangerous. Verse 15 is a picture of this crookedness of this world. The preacher's vain, elusive, futile life, he says, I've seen everything. And this is, he's had all these observations, right, in this book of Ecclesiastes. Here's another one of these observations. What has he seen? He's seen a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness at probably way too young an age, and a wicked man who prolongs his life in the midst of his wickedness. Now, this is a shocking thing for the preacher to say. We go, well, yeah, that's kind of like life, you know. But this is a shocking thing for a preacher to say, because this is the polar opposite of what the Bible tends to teach, isn't it? You know, you read the Bible, and especially when you read the book of Proverbs and Psalms, they give us a very different picture. Long life is connected with righteousness in the Bible. You know, like Proverbs chapter 3, verse 1, my son, do not forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments, for length of days and years of life and peace they will add to you. Your life will be longer because if you keep my commandments, if you follow the path of wisdom. In the same way, in Psalm 55, here's God telling us that the wicked have a shorter life, but you, O God, will cast them down into the pit of destruction. Men of blood and treachery shall not live out half their days, but I will trust in you. That's the general principle of the Bible. That's the general assumption of the Bible. The righteous person, God has a long life for them. The wicked person, God will cut them off. And so when Solomon comes along and says, this is what I've seen, and it's just the opposite, it's rather a shocking thing. He's seen righteous people die too young. He's seen wicked people live way too long. And you know what? So have we. And those exceptions, and that's what they are, exceptions to the general rule, those exceptions bother us. We all know good people who have died too young. We all know wicked people who have lived way too long. Take, for example, the life of Eric Little. For those of you that kind of sitting there going, oh, I kind of know that name. Where do I know that name? Little's life was made famous in the movie Chariots of Fire, right? Little was the guy that refused to race on Sunday and then won a gold medal in another event that he didn't even train for in the 1924 Paris Olympics. Within a year of his triumph, Little became a missionary in China. As author Duncan Hamilton tells us in his biography of Little entitled For the Glory, which I would recommend to you, it's a great, great book. Little has an effective ministry in China. He marries, he has a family, and then World War II comes. And he managed to get his pregnant wife and his two children safely to Canada before he himself is arrested and he's placed in an internment camp with 2,000 other prisoners. And this is the best part of that biography, because his time in that internment camp is often something we don't hear about. You know, and so this book, For the Glory, unpacks that a lot. He has this incredible ministry in this internment camp. He is this living, breathing example of Christ in this prisoner of war camp. But before the war ends, Little gets sick and dies at the age of 42 of a brain tumor, never seeing his family, never ever meeting his unborn child. A story like that is a picture of what Solomon's talking about here, right? There are times in this crooked world where the righteous die too long, too young, and the wicked live too long. So what's the answer to that? His answer is kind of shocking to us, at least at first glance. He seems to be saying that the answer is, don't be too righteous, don't be too wicked, somehow play this middle of some kind of spiritual mediocrity here. That's what it looks like when you read these passages. Is that really what he's saying? I think the key to understanding these verses are the words that are found in verse 16 there. Do not be overly righteous and do not be too wise. Now we know Solomon is not against righteousness. He's not against wisdom. But this verse is a warning. This verse is a warning for the person who seeks those things and trusts those things in some twisted human attempt to control life, in some attempt to be overly righteous enough to impress God, in some attempt to be too wise, so wise that we're so wise we're going to avoid life's pitfalls. We're going to avoid life's crookedness, so to speak. And the person that he's warning here is a person who is using their own righteousness, using their own wisdom as an insurance policy against a calamity like dying young. And to this person he asks, why do you destroy yourself? Why do you destroy your life seeking a power, a control you can never have? Why chase after that all your life and stress out about that and end up destroying yourself for something you will never grasp a hold of? In the same way, he calls his readers not to be overly wicked either in verse 17, or to be a fool. You know, just as it is smart to avoid an excessive pursuit of human wisdom and human righteousness, diving into wickedness headfirst is equally as stupid, if not more so. And he warns them, why would you die before your time? Think about it this way. You know, while there are some wicked people in the world that live long lives, you know, and such people are rarely found in retirement homes celebrating their 90th birthday. Ever thought about that? The vast majority, for example, of the murders that take place in a city like Chicago are because overly wicked people are killing other overly wicked people. I realize there are innocent bystanders there too. I get that, and that's tragic. But the bulk of it is because these wicked people are killing other wicked people. Solomon says if you run with that crowd, you're likely going to die before your time. That's what he's saying here. And so in verse 18, he counseled that it's good for us to take hold of this. It is good for us to grasp this. Do not withhold your hand from these things. For what? For the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. In other words, the person who fears God will not dive into wickedness, but they will not trust their own righteousness or wisdom either. Instead of grasping to control life, instead of diving into evil, we ought to grasp hold of God. The one who looks to God alone, trusts God alone, is the one who's going to avoid both of these temptations, the temptation of lawlessness on one hand and the temptation of some kind of religious arrogance of trusting our own wisdom, being overly righteous on the other. So in other words, wisdom can be dangerous. Human wisdom can be dangerous. Human wisdom can tempt us to think that it is the answer for everything. It can make us arrogant before God in our attempts to exercise control in this crooked world where God is very much the sovereign being. Human wisdom has limits. And if it's completely trusted, it can lead us down a path where we no longer fear, we no longer reverence God as the Holy One, as the Sovereign One, as we ought to. So human wisdom is good, but it's not ultimate. Trusting human wisdom can be dangerous if that is what we're putting our trust in. Second, in verses 19 to 22, we see wisdom's hindrance. Is there something that hinders human wisdom from being that ultimate answer in our life? Because you know what? It'd be really nice if human wisdom was the ultimate answer in our life, that we could achieve that. We can chase after that. You know, but is there something that hinders that? Verse 19 sounds like something Solomon himself could have written in the book of Proverbs. Wisdom gives strength to the wise men more than 10 rulers who are in a city. The preacher is picturing a city with a council of 10 governing it, and he says that one wise person has more strength, more power, more effectiveness than all 10 of the city rulers. In other words, he's basically saying here, wisdom is a great thing to have. This is what you want. But then he immediately writes verse 20. And if verse 19 sounds like it could have been ripped from the book of Proverbs, verse 20 sounds like he stole it from the Apostle Paul. And we know that didn't happen because Apostle Paul lived 1,000 years later, but that's what it sounds like. Wisdom is a great thing, but there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Wisdom is a great thing, but it is tainted and hindered by the fact that every human being is sinful. Wisdom is a great thing, but even the wise person is a flawed person. Despite the strength of wisdom, no one is perfectly wise. No one is perfectly sinless. There is no one on earth is good all the time and never sins. Or, as Paul puts it, as it is written, none is righteous, no, not one, and all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. You see, sin is the universal problem that hinders the exercise of human wisdom. Human wisdom can be a great thing. It can make someone stronger than 10 rulers, Solomon says. But can never be totally trusted because it is always being dragged down by sin. Even the wisest person you know, Solomon says, is a sinner. And just in case you don't believe him, he gives an example in verses 21 and 22. He tells us not to take to heart all the things that people say, lest a person hears their servant cursing them. In other words, masters shouldn't listen too closely to their servants because they're going to hear themselves being criticized. It's bound to happen. You know, this applies to masters and slaves. This applies to employees, employers. This applies among friends. Sometimes the people close to you gossip about you. They slander you. They even curse you. And we cannot let that go to our hearts. Why? Because in verse 22, your heart knows how many times you have done the same kind of thing. You know how many times you've been guilty of gossip or slander or cursing others. Sin is universal. Everybody is guilty. We're all sinners because in our very nature, we are inescapably sinful. In 1908, the Times newspaper of London asked a few authors that were popular in those days to write on the topic of what is wrong with the world. They kind of sent this message out. They said, can you please address this topic in our newspaper? What is wrong with the world? And so Christian writer and poet and theologian G.K. Chesterton offered probably the most famous answer to the question, definitely the shortest answer to the question. On the topic of what is wrong with the world, Chesterton wrote this, "Dear sirs, I am. Sincerely yours, G.K. Chesterton." That's the truth Solomon wants us to grasp here, isn't it? We're all guilty. And the result of that for living is that our wisdom is hindered by our sin. It is tainted by our sin. It is corrupted by our sin. There is no such thing as perfect human wisdom. That doesn't mean we can't make wise choices, but our wise choices are not infallible because of the corrupting power of sin. Human wisdom is hindered by the reality of sin. Now, the preacher has a third point to make about wisdom in verses 23 to 29. This is where the text gets really interesting, isn't it? Human wisdom is good, but it's not ultimate because wisdom has a challenge attached to it. Simply put, the true wisdom is difficult to obtain even for the best persons. That's the challenge. Wisdom is hard to find. Wisdom is hard to obtain. It is rare to find a truly wise person. When we seek out and search out wisdom, it is like it is so far away, so buried deep down in the ground, we cannot attain it. We cannot find it. We cannot grasp it. Now, these verses are difficult to interpret. If you're female and you were listening when I read them earlier, perhaps you were immediately offended by what he said about women. All right, I get that. In our world of Me Too, Solomon sounds like an ugly misogynist. So is that really the case? As I study this passage, I discovered three main ways that people have been interpreting these verses. And I'm going to share them with you from the least likely in my mind to the most likely. First, some see these verses through modern glasses and assume that the preacher is that misogynist. He is that anti-female chauvinist pig. He has nothing good to say about women here, and so his words can just be jettisoned. Let's cut that right out of the Bible. And since we live in a culture where certain things are unforgivable, right? That means jettisoning the whole book, if we have to. But I don't believe that's what he says here. I don't think that's consistent with who Solomon is. We're going to see him say some very positive things about women in the chapters to come in Ecclesiastes. This is the same guy who wrote Proverbs 31, right? I don't think that's an accurate statement. Second, we could choose to look at these verses as an allegory. Ecclesiastes is intimately connected with the book of Proverbs, and even if the preacher seems to question some of the Proverbs, the principles Proverbs contains, there seems to be a connection between them. And if you've read Proverbs, especially the first, say, 9 chapters or so, what you see in Proverbs is a picture, a portrait of two women. There's wisdom and there's folly. And both wisdom and folly are portrayed as female. Wisdom is a woman who promises great blessing, and folly is an evil seductress who traps men and destroys their life. And in this interpretation, Solomon's words about a woman who traps men could refer to folly. The woman who could not be found could refer to wisdom. And all of this is possible. We could allegorize this all. Sometimes it's very convenient to be able to do that. But I don't know that this is the best interpretation. Especially since more than halfway through this book and really haven't seen the preacher use allegory or refer so closely to the book of Proverbs. So the third interpretation is probably the best one. And that is to understand these difficult verses as a picture of Solomon's own experience. These are Solomon's personal testimony regarding his search for wisdom. And as you see, this is how I think it's best to understand the passage. You feel free to disagree with me. This is how I'm going to approach it this morning. So the challenge of wisdom is that it is very difficult to get a hold of. And the preacher's life is a testimony of that. He begins in verse 23 by noting all of this, the things that he had just written, he tested by wisdom, right? He committed himself to being wise, but as he notes, it was far from him. Despite his desire to be wise, to pursue wisdom, to test life with wisdom, he couldn't manage it. Look at verse 24. He says, talks about the thing that is far off, the thing that is very, very deep. You know, he pictures wisdom as being far off, like halfway across the world. He pictures wisdom as being buried way, way deep in the ground, beyond the ability of human beings to attain it. Again, you know, we see the limits here. We pursue wisdom. We chase after wisdom. Can we really grasp it? We can chase wisdom as the key to meaning in life, but can we understand truly what is wise? And so despite the challenges, the preacher turns his heart, he says, to know, to search out, to seek wisdom. Look at verse 25. These three verbs are repeated, right? Know, search out, seek. This shows the depths of his search, the diligence that he is applying here. He has bent all his energies to discover the scheme of things, to discover how things work. He wants to know wisdom. He wants to know folly. He wants to be able to navigate life. I remember when our kids were younger, and Jared's here this morning, and specifically Jared, one of the books I know he liked to look at was a book called The Way Things Work. And author David McCauley explained the principles behind things with diagrams and explained how things like combustion engines or jet planes worked, you know. And it was cool for him to look at it, and everything's broken apart, and you know, all this great picture book where it explains this stuff. Well, you know what? Solomon wants to do the same. He wants to find out the scheme of things. But he's not dealing with an engine, he's not dealing with a plane, he's dealing with life in a crooked world. And it's not so easily explained. The scheme of things is not so easy to discover. But he did discover some things in his search, what did he discover? He discovered in verse 26 something more bitter than death. He discovered or encountered a woman, he says, whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are fetters. Now, ladies, he's not talking about women in general here. He's talking about a particular type of woman with a particular condition of the heart. This is a woman who uses her body and her words to get the notice of a man and set a trap for him. And apparently Solomon, to his grief, has experience with just such a woman, which means Solomon is a certain type of man as well. Is it not true? He's the kind of man who allows his heart to be taken by her, a man who is not concerned with the commitments he has made, whether that's to God or his wife. And in seeking wisdom, Solomon found a trap, and in his sin, he was foolish enough to step into it. But this kind of woman is not a trap for everyone, he says. Look at the end of verse 26. The one who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner, and the preacher seems to fall into that category, is taken by her. The one who has their eyes on God escapes such a trap. The one who has their eyes firmly on the temptation, he says, will never escape. That is true for anyone and any kind of temptation. That's not all the preacher found, much to his pain. He found something else. And what he found is actually what he did not find. In his search for wisdom, he looked for wisdom among the people surrounding him. He looked for wise men and wise women, women and men who lived in wisdom. And verse 28 tells us what he found. He found one man in 1,000 and not a wise woman among 1,000. So in other words, this whole thing is very rare to find a wise person in your life. Now again, ladies, before you get insulted, before you assume Solomon thinks women are not ever wise, remember, I think this the best way to see this is Solomon's own experience. Among 1,000 men he had contact with during his days, he found one wise man. And how about the 1,000 women he had contact with? Who were they? I think the answer might surprise you. A few weeks ago, when Nathan preached, Nathan and Kayla are down in Wyoming, I think, this weekend. When Nathan preached, he had us do a little math exercise. Remember that, right? We had to get our cell phones out, get the calculator. I got a math exercise for you this morning. It is not as near as difficult as Nathan's, okay? Trust me. No need for calculators today. So let me ask you, how many wives did Solomon have? Well, yes, too many is a good answer, but how many specifically? Anybody remember? 700. There it is from 1 Kings. He had 700 wives who were princesses. And how many concubines or secondary wives? Anybody remember? 300. Let's do the math. What do you think? Let's do the math. All right? You add those two numbers in your head. What do you get? You get 1,000. I think those are the 1,000 women Solomon's talking about here in verse 28. I really do. I mean, so Solomon found wisdom in one of 1,000 men. Solomon did not find wisdom in any of the 1,000 women he is married to. Why? Why is that? What does the Bible say? And his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old and his wives turned away his heart after other gods and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. That's why there's no wisdom there. And so here he writes in Ecclesiastes, and I think this is in his old age, and he's come to realize the folly of all this. He married wisdom, not for their wisdom, not for their godliness. He probably married them for their beauty, the political advantage they ought to offer, who knows what. And the result is their hearts were a bitter trap for him. They led him away from God, and to be fair, he allowed that to happen. He went willingly, right? He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And so in this verse, I don't think Solomon is insulting all women. He is sharing his sad, his bitter, his personal experience regarding the women he knew best. And how among those 1,000 women, he didn't find anyone with wisdom. And again, whose fault is that? It was him who chose them, right? He did discover one more thing in his search for wisdom. Search for women. He's got plenty of those. And you know what? This last thing is the most important. Here's the three things he learned, right? There's women that are snared, a type of man that falls into. It's very rare to find one wise person. Here's the third thing. And this is the most important thing. If you don't remember anything else, remember this. Verse 29. He found that God made men, humans, upright, but they have sought out many schemes. What is it? We live in a crooked world, right? But God didn't create the crookedness. Rather, God made things what? What's straight, upright, righteous, good. It's human beings that chose the crookedness. Our world is still crooked today because God allows us to live in the crookedness that we have chosen. Instead of valuing the uprightness God created us with, the preacher says here that we have our own schemes, we have our own plans, we have our own plots. And you know what? From the beginning, from Genesis 3, we human beings have always figured we knew more than God. We knew better than God. We could make smarter decisions than God. We had more wisdom than God. And our schemes inevitably involve pursuing our autonomy from God rather than being dependent on Him, right? We always want to live in independence from God rather than dependence in Him. We scamper around the earth, we scheme against one another, we scheme against God, and in the end, human beings, left to their own devices, they look nothing like God. Do you want to know why the world is crooked? This is the answer. You want to know why your life is crooked? This is the answer. The problem with the world is not God. The problem with our crooked world is us. But thankfully, human beings in all their schemes do not have the final word. It's a good thing we don't have the final word sometimes. Thankfully, God, in His wisdom and His love, sent Jesus to straighten out what we made crooked. Thankfully, God sent Jesus to provide the answer to our sin, the answer to our crookedness. In His sacrifice, Jesus paid for our sin. He bore the wrath of God against our wickedness. He paid the penalty for our crookedness. And in doing so, He gave us the opportunity to be upright once again, to see God transform us through His Spirit into someone that more resembles the image of Jesus Christ Himself.